And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, this is day three of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And our illustrious president is praying and shaking his finger at Putin, telling him to mind his manners. I mean, let's face it. We were the world's policemen, and now we're doing good if anybody listens to us. Well, this is the 56th day of the year. 309 days remain to the end of the year. On this day in 138, Roman Emperor Hadrian adopts Antoninus Pius as his son, effectively making him his successor. 628, Khosrow II, the last great Shah of the Sasanian Empire, which was Iran, is overthrown by his son, Kavad II. In 1336, 4,000 defenders of Pliny, which was a hill fort in the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, it defended against the Teutonic Order in 1336. But on this particular day in 1336, 4,000 defenders of that hill fort committed mass suicide rather than be taken captive by the Teutonic Knights. Teutonic Knights were the German version of the Knights Templar. 1836, Samuel Colt is granted a U.S. patent for his revolver, the weapon that made all men equal. 1843, Lord George Paulet occupies the Kingdom of Hawaii in the name of Great Britain in the Paulet Affair in 1843. 1870, Hiram Rhodes Lervilles, Republican from Mississippi, sworn into the U.S. Senate, became the first African-American to ever sit in Congress. 1875, Ganzhou Emperor of the Qing Dynasty, China, begins his reign under the Empress Dowager Cixi's regency. 1812, Marie Adelaide, the eldest of six daughters of Guillaume IV, becomes the first reigning Grand Duchess of Luxembourg. I've been to that country. It's very nice. Near McDonald's. And they're in a fight. Just walked in and took over. 1918, German forces captured Tallinn and to virtually complete the occupation of Estonia. 1921, Georgian capital Tbilisi falls to the invading Russian forces after heavy fighting, and the Russians declare that the Georgian Soviet Socialist Republic is now in operation. 1932, Hitler, having been stateless for 7 years, obtains German citizenship when he is appointed a Brunswick state official by Dietrich Klotz, a fellow Nazi. As a result, Hitler is able to run for Reich president in the 1932 election. 1933, launch of the USS Ranger at Newport News, Virginia, the first purpose-built aircraft carrier to be commissioned by the U.S. Navy. 1939, as part of the British air raid precautions, the first of 2.5 million Anderson shelters is constructed in a garden in Islington in North London. Now, an Anderson shelter was designed in 1938 by William Patterson and Oscar Carl Carrison in response to requests from the Home Office. Named after Sir John Anderson, the Lord Privy Seal, with special responsibility for preparing air raid precautions immediately prior to the outbreak of World War II. And he then initiated the development of the shelter. It was designed to accommodate up to six people. The main principle of the protection was based on curved and straight galvanized corrugated steel panels. Six curved panels were bolted together at the top, forming the main body of the shelter. Straight sheets on either side, and two more straight panels were fixed to each end, one containing the door. That's a total of 14 panels. A small drainage sump was often incorporated in the floor to collect rainwater seeping into the shelter. It was 6 feet high, 4.5 feet wide, and 6.5 feet long. Either buried 4 feet deep in the soil and then covered over with a minimum of 15 inches of soil above the roof, or in some cases installed inside people's houses and covered with sandbags. When reared outside, the earth banks could be planted with vegetables and flowers, and at times could be quite an appealing sight, and in this way it become the subject of competitions and the best planted shelter among households in the neighborhood. It performed well under blast and ground shock, good connectivity and ductility, which meant they could absorb a great deal of energy through plastic deformation without falling apart. Into the war, households that received an Anderson shelter expected to remove the shelter, and local authorities began the task of reclaiming the corrugated iron. Householders who wished to keep their Anderson shelter, or more importantly, the valuable metal, could pay a nominal fee. But there are many Anderson shelters in existence today. Now, many were dug up after the war and converted into storage sheds for use in gardens and allotments. Then there was something else called a Morrison shelter. It was a cage-like construction, officially termed table indoor shelter. It was provided free to households whose combined income was less than 400 pounds per year. That's the equivalent of 25,000 pounds in 2020. So we're talking about the poorer end of the society. 1941, the outlawed Communist Party of the Netherlands organized a general strike in German-occupied Amsterdam to protest against Nazi persecution of the Jews, of Dutch Jews. 1947, the formal abolition of Prussia is proclaimed by the Allied Control Council, the Prussian government having already been abolished by the Prübenslag in 1932. 1947, Soviet NKVD forces in Hungary abduct Bela Kovacs, Secretary General of the Majority Independent Smallholders Party, and deport him to the USSR in defiance of Parliament. His arrest is an important turning point in the communist takeover of Hungary. 1948, in a coup d'etat led by Clement Gottwald, the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia takes control of the government in Prague to end the Third Czechoslovak Republic. On this day in 1951, the first Pan-American Games are officially opened in Buenos Aires by Argentine President Juan Perón. 1956, in his speech on the cult of personality and its consequences, Nikita Khrushchev, leader of the Soviet Union, denounces Stalin. 1980, the government of Suriname is overthrown by a military coup led by Desi Bouterse. 1986, the People Power Revolution, President of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos, flees the nation after 20 years of rule. Corazon Aquino becomes the Philippines' first woman president. And Marcos' wife had to leave 100 pair of shoes behind in her dressing room. 1991, disbandment of the Warsaw Pact at a meeting of its members in Budapest took place on this date. All right, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history, most of which wouldn't mean much to anybody. Holidays and observances. Christian feast days, Adalbert of Kent, Blessed Ciriaco, Maria Sancha y Hervás, Gerlin of Agrigento, John Roberts, writer and missionary in the Anglican Communion, Blessed Maria Adeodata Pisani, St. Walpurga, who was canonized May 1st, 870, and Walpurgis Night is celebrated. Walpurgis Night is celebrated on the 30th of April. Catano Baca Sai, or Plum Blossom Festival, at the Catano Tenmangu Shrine in Kyoto, Japan. Memorial Day of the Victims of the Communist Dictatorships in Hungary. National Day in Kuwait. People Power Day in the Philippines. Revolution Day in Suriname. Soviet Occupation Day in Georgia. And see if we've got anything else to talk about. All righty. In 1095, we had the Council of Rockingham. Bishop Anselmus versus King William II Rufus. 1358, Del Monte flees Venice. 1502, Austrian Emperor Maximilian I reformats government machine. 1570, Pius V, Pope Pius V, excommunicates Queen Elizabeth I of England for heresy and persecution of English Catholics during her reign. Also, he absolves her subjects from having any allegiance to the crown. Now, it's all well and good for a man who thinks he's God's spokesman to make such statements. But at the end of the day, the troops were loyal to Queen Elizabeth I. 1605, Portuguese garrison on Amboin surrenders to Admiral van der Hagen. 1623, Duke Maximilian I of Bavaria becomes monarch of Paltz. 1634, Irish Captain Walter Devereux kills Duke Wallenstein. 1643, the Bavonia Massacre. Dutch colonists in the U.S. kill 120 Algonquin Native Americans at Communipaw in New Jersey. 1667, Abraham Grzinin's fleet reaches Fort Willoughby on the Suriname River. 1746, the Duke of Cumberland's troops occupy Aberdeen. 1751, the first performing monkey exhibited in America, right before his election to Congress. Admission to see him was 1 cent. 1791, the first bank of the U.S. is chartered. 1795, French politician and educator Joseph Lecanto defines and on behalf of the French Revolution an educational utopia, aiming to put an end to inequalities of development that affected a child's capabilities for judgment. Another pie-in-the-sky liberal. 1799, the first federal forestry legislation authorizes purchase of timberland. 1799, Congress passes the first federal quarantine legislation. 1803, in the last significant act of the Holy Roman Empire, more than 100 German polities are abolished in a major internal reorganization. 1804, on this date, Thomas Jefferson is nominated for U.S. President at the Democratic Republican Caucus. 1814, Australia's first currency, known as the Holy Dollar, introduced. It's made of Spanish pieces of eight with the center stamped out for the colony of New South Wales. 1836, showman P.T. Barnum exhibits African-American slave Joyce Heath, claiming she was a 161-year-old nursemaid to George Washington. And she never denied it. 1837, as Barnum said, is one born every day. The first U.S. electric printing press is patented by Thomas Davenport on this date. And the printing press has certainly seen a lot of use over the years. Now my system just went to a security camera. I don't know why. 1838, a London pedestrian walks 20 miles backward and then 20 miles forward in 8 hours. What was the purpose? Nobody knows. 1839, the Seminoles and their black allies are shipped from Tampa Bay, Florida to the west. 1847, the State University of Iowa is approved. 1855, the Bowery Boys gang leader William Poole, also known as Bill the Butcher, is shot in the back by a gang of arch rival John Morrissey in New York. He died on March 8th. 1862, Congress forms U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing to print newly issued U.S. paper money. They're called United States Notes. 1 Federal government tried to borrow money to finance the Civil War, and thanks to some shenanigans from Britain, the money could only be gotten from the Rothschild banks, and they wanted an exorbitant amount of interest. So, in 1862, the first Legal Tender Act is passed by Congress, authorizing United States note, also known as the greenback, to go into circulation. It was the first fiat paper money that was legal tender in the U.S. In effect, Lincoln financed the war out of nothing. Because fiat money exists only because we say it's money. 1863, Congress creates the national banking system and the Comptroller of Currency. In 1875, the Kiowa Indians under Lone Wolf, also known as Guipago, surrendered at Fort Sill in Oklahoma. 1879, Congress passes the first Timberland Protection Act. In 1885, Congress condemns using barbed wire around government grounds. In 1896, the Italian government decides to attack Governor Barratieri of Eritrea. In 1901, U.S. Steel Corporation is organized under J.P. Morgan Sr. In 1905, the Netherlands Verband van Werner, it's a Dutch Social Democratic Trade Union, was formed on this date. 1907, U.S. proclaims a protectorate over the Dominican Republic. 1908, the first tunnel under the Hudson River, it was a railway tunnel, opens up on this date. 1910, on this date, the Dalai Lama leaves Tibet for British India to escape Chinese troops. 1913, the 16th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution becomes law. It provides the legal basis for the institution of a graduated income tax. No government is happy if it can't get money out of its citizens. 1919, Oregon is the first state to tax gasoline, 1 cent per gallon. 1921, the living Buddha, a Tuktu, is crowned king of Mongolia as the country declares its independence from China. Excuse me. 1923, bread in Berlin rises to 2,000 marks. 1925, diplomatic relations are established between Japan and the Soviet Union. 1926, Francisco Franco becomes Spain's youngest general. He was only 33 years old. 1926, Kuomintang declares war on the government and on warlords. 1930, a Czech photographing device is patented. 1940 saw the first televised hockey game, the Rangers versus the Canadiens. 1944, U.S. Army's First Army completes its invasion plans. 1945, U.S. aircraft carriers attack Tokyo. 1945, World War II, Turkey declares war on Germany. Let's see. Well, in 1950, a television premiere, it was called Your Show of Shows, had Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca premiered on NBC. The writers were the famed Mel Brooks, Neil Simon, and Woody Allen. In 1954, Abdul Gamal Nasser appointed Egyptian premier. Got anything else? In 1964, Muhammad Ali, born Cassius Clay, wins his first world heavyweight boxing title when Sonny Liston fails to come out for round 7 at the Convention Center, Miami Beach. Ali used to say he floated like a butterfly and stung like a bee. And I think that's got it. You know, we've been talking in the last couple of shows about time travel. Now, there are those that say there's nothing to it. And there are those that actually claim to be time travelers. And sometimes make predictions of things that they say is going to happen that do. We've been talking about whether or not it's possible Sasquatch is a time traveler. We've got a creature around here called the Horizon City Monster. And got a story by a lady who lives east of El Paso out in the desert. It says she spotted the Bigfoot hunched over a dead coyote by the edge of the highway out in the desert. As she drove closer, the creature got up, walked up a mesquite mound, and jogged down the other side. She said his head was originally taller than the mound, but he kept appearing to go down and down and down, like he was going down a set of steps into the ground. And although she didn't see the creature actually entering the ground due to the mound being in the way, she insisted there had to have been a cave that it went into. Well, she went on by, and the next day she came back, and the coyote was gone, footprints wiped out by the wind, and she couldn't find an apparent cave entrance. So she decided the Bigfoot must have had a trap door hidden under the dirt which he entered, but she couldn't find it. She was going through her mental gyrations, attempting to rationalize what she saw to explain an unexplainable disappearance of Bigfoot. I mean, if he didn't go into the ground, how did he make her think he did? And more to the point, where did he actually go? You know, throughout the 70s, several credible reports came from the Palmdale-Lancaster area of the Mojave Desert. A lot of strange stories come out of the Mojave Desert. Its activities reported on and around Edwards Air Force Base. Military personnel reported they had watched Sasquatches walk through the base at night. Now, the personnel who reported this, of course, did so anonymously and were told that these creatures were not reported to the public in order to avoid embarrassment on the government's behalf. Since they couldn't explain what these creatures were or how they got on the base in such high security area. I mean, they actually showed up on the security cameras. But, of course, now the interesting thing, I don't know what happened to my system. It reverted to what I'd already recorded. For those that are not familiar, these podcasts are done earlier than when they play. But as I was saying, the base security cameras picked up the creatures, but nothing was talked about because they didn't want, you know, tapes were immediately classified for fear of embarrassing the military. Now, George Knapp, longtime paranormal investigator and radio presenter, wrote a book called Path of the Skinwalker in 2002. And he wrote about some very unusual happenings at a place called the Skinwalker Ranch in Ballard, Utah. Now, he said some very strange things have happened at the spot where I'm sitting. It's here a visitor was accosted by a roaring but nearly invisible creature, something akin to the predator of the Schwarzenegger movie fame. It's here that a PhD physicist reported his mind was invaded, literally taken over by some sort of hostile intelligence that warned him he wasn't welcome. It was also on Skinwalker Ranch that an entire team of researchers watched in awe as a bright door or a portal opened up in the darkness and a large creature crawled out before quickly vanishing. It's also here that several animals, cattle and dogs, were mutilated, obliterated, or simply vanished. I guess the question is, are these creatures simply disappearing into portals and time traveling in front of our eyes? Or is something else happening? Now, Scott Corrales is a writer and translator of paranormal subjects in Latin America. Wrote a book called Patterns in the Void, Dimensions Beyond Our Own. He talks about a strange story. He said this account of a possible visit to another dimension in time or space was forwarded to him by Dr. Raul Rios Santino, investigator of the unexplained in Lima, Peru. He said a number of years ago, a patient came to see him about a serious case of hemiplegic paralysis of the arm, leg, and torso on one side of the body. He said to be 30, claimed to be 30 years old, but couldn't prove it, stating she had lost her formal identification card. CAT scans showed no signs of trauma. EEG showed paralysis due to the lack of electrical current transmissions on that half of her body. When the doctor began asking her questions, the patient told him she was at a campground in the vicinity of the ancient stone forest, Marquasi, went out exploring late that night with some friends. Oddly enough, they heard the strains of music and noticed a small torch-lit stone cabin. Says she could see people dancing inside, and when she got close, felt a sudden sensation of cold, which she paid a little attention to. Stuck her head through the open door, and then she saw the occupants were dressed in 17th century fashion. She was planning on going into that room, but one of her girlfriends pulled her out. And at that point, her body became paralyzed, and half precisely she was drawn out of that stone cabin. Now, the cause of this paralysis is unknown. No medical test was able to determine its cause. Nonetheless, an EEG was able to show that the left hemisphere of the brain didn't show signs of normal functioning, as well as it showed an abnormal amount of electrical waves. Many Peruvians claim to have had contact experiences in Marquasi, and many scholars indicate the existence of a dimensional doorway there. Now, of course, no conclusive proof of this exists. Some folks who visited the stone forest can attest to the existence of a strange kind of energy. According to those people have acknowledged it as subject, dimensional doorways tend to open and close, not necessarily in specific places. Unanswered question is, of course, what would have happened if her body had entered completely into the stone cabin? Would she have actually gone into another dimension? There's no actual answer to that. But tests lead the doctor to believe that the dimensional shift or partial entry of this person into this anomalous zone may have been able to produce a change in the energy flow existing in her nervous system, maybe even a change in the type of energy. Scott Corrales commented that religions throughout the course of human history have expressed a belief in parallel worlds adjacent to our own, usually accessible only to travel shamans and sorcerers or people gifted with special insight. Certain parts of the world were famous as locations in which the barrier between the dimensions or worlds was particularly slender and were known as places where wonderful and sometimes frightening sights could be seen. Also as locations where human intruders could vanish without a trace. Almost all traditions express a belief that there's life in these alternate universes. Carlos Castaneda wrote that the sorcerer Don Juan Matas believed in the existence of an area best described as a crevice between realities, in which the material world imperceptibly gives way to other dimensions. But only somebody well-versed in the hidden lore may recognize these gateways for what they are and make use of them. Now, in both Western and Eastern cultures alike, we're told to believe in a spirit world, a parallel universe in which our deities, our minions, and their adversaries appear to dwell. This belief is so deeply rooted, to even question it is an exercise in futility. But even when the mathematicians and quantum physicists insist that such levels of existence are not only possible but probable, 20th century humanity literally refuses to believe there could well be the mercy of forces beyond his comprehension. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about the relationship between time porters and missing people. And though some missing persons do return, there's a database across the world full of hundreds of thousands of missing people that have gone missing for years. These people who are living with their families one day, then gone suddenly the next, never to be seen again. I mean, literally, they are gone without a trace. You can see stories about this weekly in the local newspapers. Christina Schumacher reports in the Night Watchman Chronicles on one of these stories took place in 1854 in Selma, Alabama. Farmer Orion Williamson stepped off his front porch to go across the field to bring his horses from the pasture to the barn. His wife and child stood on the porch railing watching him go, and two neighbors waved at him as they rode by in their buggies. And at that moment, he vanished right before their eyes of four witnesses. He was just gone. Family and the two neighbors immediately went out to see where he had gone, thinking he may have fallen in a hole. But the field was normal. No holes, no caves, just a flat field. Well, help was summoned. Townspeople and dogs came in to search, but there was no sign of Orion ever discovered. He had vanished without a trace before the eyes of loved ones and friends, and he never came back. Now, just as strange are the disappearances of three boys. 16-year-old Charles Ashmore of Quincy, Illinois, 1876. The 11-year-old Oliver Larch from South Bend, Indiana, in 1889. An 11-year-old Oliver Thomas from Riata, Wales, in 1909. And though the years are different, the circumstances about the vanishing of these three boys was very similar. All three vanished on Christmas Eve. They're on their way to the family well to fill a bucket with water to bring to the house. None of them ever got to the well. Their footprints in the snow stopped halfway to the well, and the only variance in the three stories is that Charles Ashmore was never heard screaming anything before his disappearance. He was just gone too long, so his father and sister went to look for him. He was never found. The other two boys were heard shortly after leaving the house. One cried out, "Help," and the other shouted, "Help, help, they've got me." But none of these boys were ever seen again. And just as strange was the disappearance of James Worson in 1873. He made a bet with three of his friends that he could jog 16 miles round trip from Leamington Spa in England, where they lived, to Coventry and back. Oh, he started jogging with all three friends riding along behind him in a cart. He'd gone several miles when suddenly he stumbled, pitched forward, and vanished. His friend stopped the cart and jumped out, thinking the road had somehow given way, but the road was just as it should have been, and he was gone. His friends went back to Leamington and Spa and straight to the police station. They were questioned extensively, but couldn't add anything to their stories they hadn't previously said. James was running in front of him, and then he was gone. Excuse me. Never seen again. Now, these are just a sample of the cases where the annals of history whose stories were reported. There are certainly a lot of others that could be found in small-town local papers if a person was inclined to do such a search. So, did these people simply accidentally enter portals and disappear to time and space to reappear in another timeline? Were they perhaps in some fashion their molecules scattered? Well, NASA has weighed in on the idea of portals. A NASA-sponsored research at the University of Iowa has developed a way for spacecraft to hunt down hidden magnetic portals in the vicinity of Earth. These gateways are said to link the magnetic field of our planet to that of the sun. Now, a favorite theme of science fiction is the portal, an extraordinary opening in space and time that connects travelers to distant realms. If only they actually existed. Well, according to NASA, they do. And a NASA-funded researcher has figured out how to find them. Plasma physicist Jack Scudder of the University of Iowa says, "We call them X-points, or electron diffusion regions. They're places where the magnetic field of Earth connects to the magnetic field of the sun, creating an uninterrupted path leading from our own planet to the sun's atmosphere 93 million miles away. observations by NASA's Themis spacecraft and Europe's cluster probes suggest these magnetic portals open and close dozens of times each day. They're typically located a few tens of thousands of kilometers from Earth, where the geomagnetic fields meet the onrushing solar wind. Now, most of these portals are small and short-lived. Others are vast and sustained. Tons of energetic particles can flow through the openings, heating Earth up in the atmosphere, sparking geomagnetic storms, and igniting bright solar auroras. Now, NASA's planning a mission. It's called MMS, short for Magnetospheric Multiscale Mission, which was launched in 2014 to study the phenomena. Bristling with energetic particle detectors and magnetic sensors, the four spacecraft of this mission will spread out an Earth's magnetosphere and surround the portals to observe how they work. The only problem with their theory is how to find them. Magnetic portals are invisible, unstable, and elusive. They open and close without warning, and there's no signpost to guide us. At least that was the belief. But Scudder has found the signpost. Portals form via the process of magnetic reconnection. Mingling lines of magnetic force from the sun and the earth crisscross and join to create the openings. X points are where the crisscrosses take place. Sudden joining of magnetic fields can propel jets of charged particles from the X point, creating an electron diffusion region. And to learn how to pinpoint these events, Scudder looked at data from a space probe that orbited Earth more than, over 15 years ago. Over 20 years ago. In the late 90s, NASA's Polar spacecraft spent years in Earth's magnetosphere and encountered many X points during its mission. Because Polar carried sensors similar to those that the MMS is going to use, Scudder decided to see how an X point looked to Polar. And using the Polar data, they found five simple combinations of magnetic field and energetic particle measurements that tell us when we've come across an X point. Single spacecraft with proper instrumentation can make these measurements. So this means the portals are real. And now, with these new signposts Scudder has devised, we know how to find them. Now, the Earth's energy grid is made up of what are called ley lines or meridians. Glastonbury Tor is at the center of the English ley lines, and the recently discovered Bosnian pyramid reveals very precise alignments between Earth and skies connected to other high-energy sites along the ley lines. Where these lines cross on the grid, they create a vortex of energy as the flows intersect and interact. Most powerful places are where lots of the lines cross, and these are marked by the ancients with standing stone circles and pyramids. This was done to access the energy. The Great Pyramid, Stonehenge, and Stoneheads on Easter Island, and the Sun and Moon Pyramids in Mexico. Ancient mystical sites, churches, temples, hinges, and burial sites are all built along the ley lines. In fact, over 4,000 sites of historical and spiritual significance are found in this grid. The Irish call them the fairy paths. The Germans call them the holy lines. The Greeks call them the sacred road of Hermes. Chinese call them dragon currents. Among these grids is the Becker-Huggins planetary grid. The 12 points of this grid were plotted originally by Ivan Sanderson, who identified areas on Earth where anomalous activity frequently occurred, such as weird geomagnetic activity, marine and aircraft disappearances. Now, Sanderson was a professional biologist, wrote the 12 Devil's Graveyards around the world. Highest on his statistical priority list was a lodging-shaped area east of Miami in the Bahamas on the western tip of the infamous Bermuda Triangle. Other zones of anomaly, though less familiar, were equally rich with disappearances and space-time shift occurrences. The area of continuing disappearances and mysterious time warps is the Devil's Sea, located east of Japan between Iwo Jima and Marcus Island. Here, events have become so sinister the Japanese government's officially designated the area a danger zone. After discovering there were 12 main areas in which all these activities seemed to be located, Sanderson noticed they were all equidistant from one another. When you connect all these points together with ley lines, you have a perfect icosahedron. Russian scientists Goncharov, Mazarov, and Makarov find if you take this icosahedron and flip it inside out into the dodecahedron and then plot these new points on a planetary grid with the original 12 points of the original icosahedron, you got a worldwide grid plotting every single major monolithic structure in the history of the planet. Well, Guy Baldwin, a journalist and native of the Isle of Wight, has written several books on the anomalies on the island. Interestingly, the island has an incredibly large number of ley lines running under the island. In fact, the isle is a major point on the Earth grid, or rather its meridian system is. The ley mechanics and its associated consciousness system is said to be deeply implanted into the landscape of the Isle of Wight. Now, Baldwin relates a couple of fascinating stories about what he calls time slips. The old Victorian house in Wutan on the Isle of Wight still haunts the dreams of electrical engineer Dan Cox of Clarence Rose and East Cowles, because it was there some 20 years ago he traveled back in time and glimpsed his home as it was in the 1920s. It was an incredible and terrifying experience for Mr. Cox, and even now he's not able to understand or explain it. But he does recall the details of that night with startling clarity. He says, "It wasn't a dream, I know that. But whether I actually slept back in time or saw some kind of ghost house, I just don't know." He was 20 years old, and he moved to the Isle with his parents and younger brother George in 1968. They moved in an unfurnished flat in the Brannans, a large Victorian house in Station Road. Family had a spacious apartment on the ground floor. He said the rooms were grand, high ceilings, and what had once been the lounge or drawing room had been divided into two bedrooms. He and his brother shared one. Their parents had the adjoining room. Well, one bright moonlit night, Dan woke up about 2 a.m. with a feeling something was dreadfully wrong. Glancing over to where his brother should have been, he saw a large gray upholstered sofa instead. Thinking he had to be dreaming, he turned over in bed only to find the partition wall had gone, and instead of his parents' bed, he saw the glowing embers of a dying fire in an old-fashioned cast-iron grate. He said, "I was wide awake by this time. First I was puzzled, but as the seconds ticked by, I began to panic. This was the room as it would have been 50 years before. His parents and brother had vanished. So the question is, where was he?" Well, looking desperately around that strange room, he noticed the walls were now covered with a leafy-patterned wallpaper. Looks as if electricity had been newly installed in the house, as there were hanging glass lampshade in the center of the room in place of the partition, and the cable had been fixed to the top of the wallpaper. He said, "Working with electrics, I noticed these things." He also remembers a large piano against one wall. As the seconds passed and the room didn't waver or change, he wondered if he should get up and explore the house, but he just really couldn't bring himself to get out of bed. I mean, the main fear was he might never find the bed again, be somehow trapped in that time before he was born. Closed his eyes and tried to go back to sleep. Eventually, sometime later, he opened his eyes and his brother was once more in place of the sofa and the room had returned to normal. To this day, he believes he drifted back in time. Baldwin also interviewed two other men on the island who also appeared to have traveled back in time. One dark November night, Laurie West set out from Newtown with a friend who for what appeared to be the strangest night of their lives. Now, Laurie lives and works in Reed, describing himself as a rational person now in his 50s or 60s, who, having lived on that island all his life, knows it like the back of his hand. And he's still absolutely baffled by his experience that night. On that cold, wet winter evening over 10 years before, he says, "I picked up my friend in Newtown. We set out to have a drink. As we were driving towards Shalfleet, I noticed a lane on our left. I asked my friend if he'd ever been down it." He thought it odd later that his friend didn't recognize that turn in the road because he lived in that area for a large number of years. Some way down the lane, they saw a pub on the right and pulled into the graveled area of the front. He said the car park was deserted. The pub signboard was swinging and creaking in the wind, way up high over the door. They went in through the small porch and tried the lounge bar first. It's full of heavy brown leather furniture and deserted. He said there was an unpleasant, chilly feeling, so he made for the public bar instead. He said this bar had a flagstone floor, large, empty, and cold fireplace, wooden tables and chairs. The whole atmosphere was cheerless and unfriendly. A drably dressed woman was serving behind the bar, and there were about 15 other people in the room. All were middle-aged or older and wearing what he called shabby, old-fashioned clothes. said everybody stopped talking and just stared at him as they came in. He found the whole thing rather unnerving. They continued to watch as they got their drinks. They asked for gin and ginger beer, and the barmaid said, "We don't have that." So he asked for gin and ginger ale instead. It was actually quite horrible. They sat down at one of the tables, and people around them resumed their conversation, but they kept watching them. They felt like intruders. They were clearly not welcome. He recalls paying for the drinks with a pound note and being given change in florin and shilling coins, which didn't strike him as unusual since they doubled his 10p and 5p pieces in decimal coinage. With no fire in the fireplace, the bar felt cold. Thor and his friends sipped their drinks, feeling more and more uncomfortable. He said, "We certainly didn't want in another one, so we left. I could hardly wait to get out of that place." He said, "I was aware every pair of eyes in the room followed our departure." They hurried out into the night with a feeling of relief and drove out of the car park. They drove a short way down the road and were amazed to find himself at the Sun Inn in Claiborne, or Calburn. It just wasn't possible. They hadn't yet crossed the main Newport to Yarmouth Road at any point, and he thought it strange at the time that two pubs should be so close together. Two men had a drink there, and Mr. West dropped his friend back home, still puzzling about that unfriendly pub. The whole episode disturbed him so much that a few days later, he decided to go back in daylight and try to discover why it felt so unwelcoming. He said, "I never found that pub again. I drove all over the place trying to retrace our steps, but that lane did just not exist." Eventually, he went to a little village shop in Calburn and asked if there was another pub nearby, and got the answer that there was not. Next, he inquired at the county records office about old pubs in the area and drew another blank. After hearing a story, the archivist told Mr. West he must have had too many drinks that night because there was no such place. Well, sometimes we step across the line, so to speak. In 40 and Times, a long-established British magazine on the unusual and unexplained, the reader wrote in about his experience in 2004. At about 7 p.m. on the evening of the 22nd of December, 2004, a gentleman named Mark and his girlfriend Julia set out to explore the back roads of the Catskill Mountains near Margaretville in New York. Excuse me. He was driving an F-150 pickup. He said, "I picked roads at random as we were driving, assuming I found my way back." He said, "In Pennsylvania, I always can. But after about 30 minutes, I was seriously lost, and it started snowing. A lot." So they panicked just a bit, and he drove around almost blind. The snow was coming down so hard for another hour. Then Julia looked down at the gas gauge and really got upset because they were almost on empty. He said it was a bad situation. Blizzard in the mountains when I'm lost and running out of gas. And he said this is how he heard people die. Finally, about an hour after they'd set out, they saw some lights on the road ahead and realized it was a gas station. There was a shop next door with a sign that said General Store. Relieved, Mark pulled up to the pumps, but the pumps looked ancient, like something out of the 40s. Mark's heart went down into his stomach because he thought that they were just for show. Then a man walked up and said, "You got a fancy truck there, boy. Need a fill-up?" While the man pumped gas, Mark asked him for directions back to Margaretville, which he readily gave. Julia had gone into the store to look around, and while the man was pumping gas, Mark followed her in and noticed there were three cars parked outside. He said, "All look brand new, but from the 40s. Inside, he saw Julia talking to a woman behind the counter. There were post office boxes up on the wall, big cut glass candy jars. Said he waved hello and took a look around. He said there was no modern food. Most stores, gas stations, or others do have Doritos or things like that. But not this place. They had Coke and Hershey bars, but the Coke was in glass bottles and Hershey bars were in an odd wrapper. Now, this was true for just about everything in the store. Well, Dilly had another surprise coming up when he went out to pay for the gas. Now, normally when he fills up that truck, it's about $50. Man said his total was $2.85. He said he looked at the man thinking he was joking with him. He said, "How much is the gas per gallon?" And the man said, "Well, it's 10 cents a gallon. I know it's a little high, but, you know, there's a war on." He said he gave him the money in silence, got into the car, rolled down the window to thank him, drove off using the directions he gave him. Now, the couple did eventually make it home to Julia's parents' house through the snow, but there was another odd thing. According to the clock in Mark's pickup, they'd been gone 4 hours, getting back at around 11 p.m., but the house clock said it was only 9 p.m. when they got back, and that wasn't all. By his own admission, Mark is fairly compulsive about filling up gas tanks once the destination is reached. And on arriving in Margaretville from Pennsylvania, he had duly filled up. Now, a full tank, which is about 19 gallons, would take his F-150 300 miles. Say, driving in the mountains, 250. He and Julia set out that morning with a full tank of gas. By the time they came across that 1940s gas station and general store, they were actually running on empty. As Mark said, there's no way in hell I drove 250 miles in 1 hour on back mountain roads. Well, according to the time slip theory, time is fluid rather than fixed. It's not linear as we experience it, but exists within the context of a single point of space. It's a term usually applied when a period of time, maybe minutes or even years, appears to have been lost inexplicably by one or more people, and is most commonly associated with a paranormal experience. Now, a lot of folks have reported such an experience during a journey, when the last reliable reference remembered of time is that of a clock striking or a news report on the radio, only to find out that the next time the individual becomes fully aware of time, more time than expected has elapsed. Then you have the issue of accounting for that lost time. Then we got the story told by Daisy and her friend Rick, who were driving to another friend's house in September 2004. They were driving in Rick's beat-up old truck. Suddenly, the truck's engine died, and she and Rick were stranded on a deserted highway in the middle of the night. Well, Daisy said they were surrounded on both sides of the road by cornfields that stretched out into the distance, and Rick began a desperate effort to restart the truck, but nothing seemed to work. They decided to walk to the nearest town about 2 miles away to find a payphone to call their friend. Well, they walked for what seemed like hours, and town was nowhere in sight. Just when desperation was about to grip them, they saw a light, a bright light, shining over the steep hill ahead of them. They ran up the hill that blocked them from the sight and were flabbergasted by what they saw. Just over the hill, they saw what could only be described as a futuristic city with light streaming out of every window of the massive metallic towers. In the middle of that futuristic city was a huge silver dome. Well, she just stared at the city, she said, stunned at what she was seeing until Rick elbowed her and pulled her out of her trance and pointed to the sky. Hovering above the city were hundreds of hovercraft. Well, one flew at them at amazing speed, and Rick and she were so scared they took off running back to the broken-down truck. She said she never looked back, but felt somebody watching her the whole way. When they got back to the truck, it started right up without difficulty. The two of them took off as fast as they could in the opposite direction. Never went back or spoke of it again to this day, except for telling a story a time or two. Well, then we got a story I've heard a number of times. August 19, 1942, 6,000 Allied soldiers landed at the port of Dieppe in Normandy, which was then in the hands of Nazi Germany. The mission resulted in fatalities and mass injuries for the Allied troops. 9 years later, August 4, 1951, two English women were on vacation at Pews, a village near Dieppe that had been one of the Allied troops' landing points for the battle. They woke up to the sound of gunfire. For the next 3 hours, the two ladies listened in shock to the sounds of the battle that seemingly came from nowhere. Nobody in that area heard anything except the two women, but their descriptions are close to the official reports of the event that the British Society for Psychical Research investigated the incident. After the investigation, they declared the experience had to be rated as a genuine psychic experience, which had resulted from a time slip. The description of the battle noises given by the women were compared with the official record of events, and astonishingly, they corresponded incredibly accurately. About 4 a.m., the women described being woken up by men's cries as if above a storm with distinct sounds of dive bombing and gunfire. Well, the official records say at 3:47 in the morning, Allied assault vessels exchanged fire with German ships. Troops shouted at each other, manning beach defenses. At 4:50 a.m., the ladies say it was then silent. Official records say operation running 17 minutes behind schedule. Firing may have stopped at this point. At 5:40, the women say it went silent again. Official records say naval bombardment stopped. At 5:50, the ladies say the sound of aircraft in large numbers with fainter background noises. Official records say sound of aircraft in large numbers with fainter background noises. Well, it does raise very interesting questions about how time works. You know, when U.S. troops first went into Afghanistan, rumors circulated about a time travel craft or Vermana having been found in a cave and of 8 soldiers who had apparently disappeared after going into the cave to retrieve it. In May of 2011, researchers, including Steve Quayle, wrote a source that tells the story of a team of soldiers that were killed. Source tells of a supposed Russian Foreign Intelligence Service report circulated in the Kremlin, stating that American military troops and technicians had been obliterated after the activation of the time well holding the flying craft. The Vermana was said to be in the process of being removed from its original location at Herat Province in Afghanistan to Wardak Province, where it was intended to be flown back from Kabul to the U.S. for further examination and study. Now, the method chosen for the transporting of the time well holding the Vermana was to be by airlifting it with a U.S. Army CH-47F Chinook helicopter and protecting it with an elite team of soldiers. When they got near Kabul, though, this SVR report says the mysterious Vermana suddenly accidentally activated, causing an electromagnetic shockwave to obliterate everything in the air and incinerate the helicopter. Everyone died. U.S. Department of Defense, in announcing the deaths of these soldiers, acknowledged only these U.S. soldiers have been killed in a non-combat-related incident related to fire. Now, we're going to talk more about the Vermana. But right now, we've come to the end of tonight's show. Run out of time. So until Monday, since this is Friday, Monday at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.